have some questions and some discussion. And so perhaps I'll just dive straight into throwing it open to the floor. Kate has the roving mic, which I will ask you to use for the benefit of the podcast, really. Oh, let's just keep it rolling rather than... Is it still rolling?
Yeah.
Oh, good. So questions, comments? Philip was first cab off the rank.
Hi, Philip Youngman. Philip, one of my criticisms over the years has been that most media aren't prepared to use FOI or GIPR as it is now because they're not prepared to wait. They basically want a story now and they're not prepared to do the job that's required to take the time to get what they want. Obviously, there are investigative journalists like yourself that are prepared to go through the ranks, but do you find that journalists in general have a different view now on the use of GIPR or FOI to gain information, or are they all still much of a much as they just need a story in a hurry and that's all there is to it?
I think the evidence is there that shows that the changes in the Federal FOI Act have produced a significant jump in what the Information Commissioner refers to as complex policy-related applications. But whether or not they're from journalists or from interested members of the public or NGOs or indeed business, we don't have that sort of breakdown. There certainly seems to be increased activity relating to FOI. I have a superficial impression that there's been a bit of a pickup of journalistic interest in FOI, but that's sort of anecdotal. There's a fundamental reason, though, for, I mean, in a sense, I'm reluctant to, I won't make any criticism of my colleagues. I'm a newcomer to the business of journalism and I've come to it from a very wayward path. But I do know that one of the fundamentals is that time is precious. There are fewer journalists in this country than there were 20 years ago. Fewer journalists are producing more and more product with shorter and shorter time frames. This has been widely described as a phenomenon of churnalism, where basically people are reduced to the circumstance of taking what comes into their inbox and cutting and pasting it, press releases, transcripts, and you know what's happening on the day, and then repackaging it, and then serving it out to not only meet the demands of the deadlines of the print media, but increasingly electronic media, where it's just all instant. And when you combine that time pressure with usually constrained resources, the editorial component of our newspapers is not unique to this country. It's the same in the United States, the same in the United Kingdom and indeed everywhere. Fewer and fewer journalists are producing more and more over shorter time frames, which means that much of it is surface skimming. Now, some of that surface skimming is important because people need to know what's happening on the day, but the number of journalists who actually have the time and opportunity and who are freed up from the daily news cycle to pursue investigative work, not just FOI, but you know, serious time-consuming investigative work where you might work on a story for a number of weeks, months, before you actually get a product that you can put in your outlet, be it electronic or print, is fewer and fewer. The Fairfax has got an investigative unit with the Age and Sydney Morning Herald, of which I'm associated with. The Australian has a small team of investigative journalists too. There's another handful at the ABC. But I reckon you could probably count the number of journalists in this country that you would say, you know, are committed to longer-term investigations. Probably be less than 24. So aren't people using the FOI Act? There are much bigger picture issues that constrain deeper, longer-term investigative work. I think things might have improved a little bit for the legislative context, but that's the broader picture.
Oh, yeah. Still has it.
Oh, you'll love that edit. If I can just add very quickly, three factors that
have affected that over the last 15 years. You've got an increasing casualisation of the journalistic workforce. Far more people are working as freelancers than as staffers. Freelancers are generally paid on a word rate. 15 years ago, that word rate was a dollar per word of published material. No one gets a dollar per word these days, except maybe the monthly. Fairfax freelancers get 65 cents per word, so that's not just 65% of what it was. You've got to factor in a decade and a half of inflation into that. And they're still amongst the highest paid freelancers in the country, it's sad to say. So, and on top of that, a freelancer is usually expected to come with a photograph of the people they interviewed and maybe even video of the some of the material as well to go with it. So it's a straight-up economic decision. The good side is that there is now starting to emerge almost a kind of bespoke or micro-patronage kind of freelance journalism where people will say, I would like to cover a certain issue or topic, and if I can get enough people to give me $10 or $20 each to get to $5,000 to cover the project, then I'll go ahead and do it. There's a couple of guys out of the States who are actually doing foreign correspondent work into Afghanistan on that basis.
Peter, Matt, and then Peter.
Might have to have a name first.
Two questions. You can choose from either of them. Okay. So the first one is, most enterprise search is awful, in my experience. Would we be better off outsourcing enterprise search to WikiLeaks? The second question... Second question is, so the three panellists, when have you felt most uncomfortable in what situation dealing with information privacy and openness? Up to you.
I might answer, maybe briefly.
Most uncomfortable.
With regard to the first question, I'm not sure if there'd be an answer to the question, but... I think it's one thing about to notice about the WikiLeaks model, because it's not a universal model that is applicable to media organisations. I'm certainly of the view that WikiLeaks is a media organisation, but it is essentially, at its core, is an electronic Dropbox into which things may be put by anonymous people. And then WikiLeaks has a look at it and forms judgments about what they're going to publish, either in a direct sense or through other partners. They don't choose what comes into their Dropbox. They just get to look what comes in. Now, there's a lot of difficulties associated with that. It's certainly a novel concept. At the moment, WikiLeaks Dropbox hasn't been operating for well over a year. It was talk about it being reconstituted at the end of last year, but that hasn't happened yet. So I'm not sure that... I mean, WikiLeaks basically has run the flag up and says, whistleblowers, leakers, come here. But who they are, what their agendas are, what their information is something that they determine. So WikiLeaks, I suppose, presents an opportunity, a channel for people. That's not quite the same thing as, for example, the business of investigative journalism, where you're going to sit down and make judgments about what's important, what's good, what's important in terms of news values, what's important for the readers, how you're going to go about doing that. Some of that's reactive because people provide tips, send in anonymous emails. But it's also proactive that you're going out and seeking out information in a proactive way. That involves journalists setting their own agendas, in part in response to the agendas of their media outlets. But it's an iterative process. So I'm not sure this is the answer to your question, but I think there's a range of models about how the media, and indeed how other organisations, how NGOs and community groups, are involved in the business of both gaining and disseminating information, arguing about it and so forth, and there's a multitude of models. The question about what was most awkward issue, it'd be tempting to say having the coppers turn up on my door on two occasions, but actually no, the most awkward moment, if you like, in a sense, was many years ago. I've been working on a biography of an Australian scientist for all far too many years. It's not finished yet, and maybe it never will be, but it's been a great project. To cut a long story short, the scientist in the 1940s became involved in a security investigation, and the forerunner to ASIO were very interested in a female friend of his whom they thought was a Nazi agent during the Second World War. In what was an absolute first for the Australian intelligence community, for the first time they bugged someone's phone, which was in 1944. They didn't know how to do it and had to borrow some equipment from the US Army. They also decided to bug a flat, which was in a very attractive residence in Bellevue Hills with a panoramic view out of Sydney Harbour. And they quietly pushed out the tenant from the flat above, and then they had a couple of security agents sitting in the flat and had microphones down through the ceiling. And they didn't have tape recorders, so they sat down there with their headphones, studiously taking shorthand notes and then typing them up at the end of each evening. And their diligent reports of what went on in her flat went on for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages. And in the course of my biographical research, I applied for various security files relating to my subject, my biography, and included this lady. And in due course, the archives deliberated and ASIO deliberated, and then they released them to me. And they released hundreds and hundreds of pages of verbatim transcripts of conversations and activities in her flat over a two-year period, 1944 to 1946. And it included everything from organising the shopping to her sexual liaisons with various and multitudinous partners, were all graphically listed down in salacious detail by these security fellows sitting upstairs. And they released the whole lot to me. The thing was that the lady in question is still alive, was, when I got it released a few years ago, was alive and still is. She's in her 90s. She has all of her marbles. She plays bridge twice a week at the Double Bay Bridge Club. She still lives in the same flat. Hasn't moved, and mind you, the address is that good, you wouldn't want to. This is an appalling, appalling violation of her privacy. And I got this material from a biographical point of view. It was of interest for my subject and so forth, but absolutely shocking. And it came after I'd been recently investigated and been raided by the AFP. And I have to admit, I was mortified by it because this poor lady had had such a violation of her privacy. She'd done nothing wrong. She wasn't a Nazi agent. It was all basically racist claptrap. And then actually, I'd compounded it by applying for a file and then seeking it to get copies. And it ended up being digitalised and put up on the National Archives website. And I looked at this and I then had to ring up the archives and say, you'd better have a reconsideration of this. This has obviously slipped through the net. And then I had to pick up the phone, and although it was unlikely that any of her friends at the Bridge Club had actually read it, to explain this to her, because the violation of her privacy was twofold once at the time, but then many years later. And her reaction to it, fortunately, was most gracious. She actually found it really very awkward, despite the considerable lapse of time. Most awful moment, I don't know if it was awful, but certainly awkward. And it was just an example that raised in my mind just these questions about secrecy and openness. It's a great piece of history. It's the first ever, you know, sort of electronically driven security investigation in this country. A unique piece of history in terms of the intelligence services and the like, but also a most appalling violation of someone's privacy, which I then compounded so many years later, albeit inadvertently.
It was interesting that, I don't know if you saw Persons of Interest, the exhibition at the Police and Justice Museum in Sydney, which was putting on display information from ASIO files.
I've picked over quite a few ASIO files in the course of research. These days, if I know that the subject is alive and I'm interested in him, I'll make it my business to actually contact them and see what their view is about applying for stuff. That's not always possible. And in some cases, I probably would, as a journalist or as a historian, decide to do it anyway if it was sufficiently important. But nonetheless, so I throw that in as an example of sort of these sorts of issues, which can still be very live even when the passage of time is more than half a century.
We probably just have one last question because I've the time, but that's for Peter, I think.
Thanks for your presentation, Peter Timmons. Just one issue picking up from the topic about orderly and disorderly. I guess what's very unclear is the reaction to greater disorderliness. I guess what we're expecting is that there'll be a blowback and a backlash from within about, it's happened already, I guess, with WikiLeaks and other things. On the other hand, as Philip has acknowledged, there's been some reasonable progress in terms of orderly access, but there's still a long, long way to go. Would you both like to comment about how you see this argument poised about future directions? I agree with Philip that we've made some progress, balance is the issue. It means there's more in the public domain at one end of the spectrum, but the great debate will go on forever about the grey middle ground, about what should be more open, but there's at least an argument that it shouldn't. And then we'll all agree that there is some stuff that's right at the other end of the spectrum that probably always needs to remain somewhat secret, at least for a significant period of time. But how do you see the future direction of this great debate about orderly, disorderly?
Well, I'll kick off and say, since we've had such a series of disorderly releases over the last 18 months to 2 years, I think we will have a backlash and tightening up. And I notice even just now the New York Times is reporting that 25 alleged anonymous members have been arrested across Latin America and Europe in the last 24 hours. And I think, you know, we will see a much tougher crackdown. I think we will see, and we are seeing, increasing harshness of penalties for breaches of information. You know, we've got a number of international treaties kicking around, which will enable that, and they haven't received a lot of attention. I'm thinking of all the stuff, the cybercrime legislation, cybercrime amendment bill from last year, which has already done 3 readings in the lower house here in Australia and 2 in the Senate, and there's one kind of last chance for the Senate to have a go at that, and there doesn't seem to be much enthusiasm to examining that, or at least limiting what it does, except perhaps from the Greens Senator Scott Ludlam, and one vote, or even the Greens 9 votes, won't change anything there. But I think then beyond that, I think we're at the very beginning of a power struggle. And I used sort of militaristic metaphors earlier, and that's a bit dramatic. I admit that's a bit dramatic. But I think that this is going to be a constant niggling battle, and we're at the very beginning of perhaps, I don't know, a decade of this. I don't know how it'll turn out.
I'd concur with Stuart's broad assessment that there has been a strong reaction, and that will continue, and this is going to be heavily contested for a long time to come. It's interesting, each year there's an annual national security conference that's convened academics and government by the Federal Attorney General's Department. They have a couple of public speeches, you know, and some of the journalists in the press gallery breathlessly report what the ASIO DG has to say on the public. But it's interesting, at the last one last year, in the middle of last year, they had a keynote speaker from the United States. He was a sort of a academic defence insider from sort of a Pentagon think tank. And this fellow was and is referred to in the Attorney General's open speech at the beginning of the conference. I can't remember his name, but the subject matter is of interest because he wasn't there to talk about Al-Qaeda or terrorism. He was there to talk about insider threats and the need to how to work out to deal with the insider threat. And the hunt for the trusted insider is perceived as a absolutely critical issue. This comes from the WikiLeaks background. And you can see a lot of work happening within government to once again compartmentalise information, to increase security. I mean, there are other drivers for this, including particular whole phenomenon of hacking and particularly Chinese cyber espionage. But to once again stovepipe information, increased and enhanced psychological profiling of people who might be in the system, but who then might leak or disclose information, not always to the press or to WikiLeaks or something. I mean, you're also talking about people who sell information for commercial benefit, who engage in espionage for foreign intelligence services and the like. But there's a real perception within the realm of government, I think within the private sector too, that their exclusive control over information is being challenged, and there is inevitably a kickback to that. And it's a kickback that comes in penalties and in increased investigations, and indeed in gathering more information. I mean, government employees with security clearances are now subject to more onerous investigation than they were, and I expect it's going to be probably stepped up to the point where if you want entree into the secret world, the government will own your life. So I think that's an ongoing phenomenon that's going to continue for quite a long time.
I may have to...
With little doubt.
I may have to, at that point, wrap things up. Thank you so much. I'd like to thank each of our speakers, Tim Robinson, Silverian, and Dr. Philip Dorling. And we have some gifts. Cookbooks. Thank you very
Excellent.
Much.
Excellent.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Valuable information.
Thank you. Thank you.